Hey, this is David Mazouz, Bruce Wayne from Gotham, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Comic book and superhero fans, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and I am so glad you could join me here in the lair today. I am concluding my adventure in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Cleveland's where Superman got his true origin story. Hope you caught my special episode last week, Superman in Cleveland. That's where I kicked off all this Cleveland goodness going on. Cleveland rocks. Yes, it does. The Superman exhibit at the Cleveland Public Library. That is going on through March 31st, so you still have some time to check it out. We talked about that on last week's show. We walked through the exhibit, checked all those things out. Now, if you can't make it to Cleveland, just head on over to the Comic Book Central Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. I'm taking care of all you listeners out there. You're going to find a photo album of the exhibit. You'll find a very cool video of the interactive Action Comics number one display that we talked about there. So if you haven't heard last week's episode, by all means, after today's show, go download it, go stream it, flip through the pictures on the Facebook page while you listen to it. All kinds of good Superman stuff. That kick-started my adventure in Cleveland. Today, it is my Wizard World Cleveland special. Now, I've taken the show on the road a few times over the past few years to Wizard World Cleveland and Columbus. So many cities for these folks. They are taking the show on the road all the time. So if you want to find out if there's a Wizard World event coming to a city near you, it's wizardworld.com. That's where you want to be. Everything's listed there. All the guests are listed there. Or you can just follow the link that I've placed for your convenience in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. I've also placed the link on the show notes for Blog Talk Radio. It's at blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. That's the page on Blog Talk Radio. So you check that out. Check the show notes out for this episode. That link is in there as well. Bunch of links in there. We're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today. Man, Wizard World, they always bring the heroes. This year is no exception. It was Cleveland, Ohio. It was cold. Of course it was. It was March in Cleveland. But things were heating up at the Huntington Convention Center. Today, you are going to hear from the PR manager for Wizard World, Jerry Milani. He's got some updates on a few big announcements that they've made over the past few weeks. So we're going to get some updates on those. Also, animator, director of some of our favorite Saturday morning TV shows from back in the day, including Super Friends. Oh, it's one of my favorites. The great Tom Cook. He's going to be joining me. You heard a little bit from Tom on last week's show. We were talking about Superman, so I played a clip of Tom talking about Superman while I was chatting with him. So you can check that out. You're going to hear more from him today. Then you're going to hear from comic book writer, artist Carl Potts. He worked on one of my favorite comic books, The $6 Million Man magazine. He worked with Neil Adams. He did a bunch of Marvel work, The Punisher, The Hulk, Defenders, on and on and on and on. He's done a bunch of stuff. So we're going to be chatting with Carl. Then we're headed to Springfield with artist animator Phil Ortiz. He worked on the Simpsons TV series back in the day. He's been working on the Simpsons comic book for almost a quarter of a century. Man, a huge run on that comic book. We are going to get Simpsonized with Phil. Gotham City came to Cleveland this year, and Bruce Wayne and Alfred, David Mazouz and Sean Pertwee, they were there. You're going to hear from both of those gents. They're also going to give us a little preview of what's remaining for season four. So season four kicked back in full swing. We're going to get a little preview of what's ahead. And you want more superheroes? Look, you're in the right place, man. That's where I bring them to you. You're going to get some superheroes. It wasn't easy, but I got two members of the Justice League. Yeah, that Justice League. Last year's Justice League, the blockbuster film. The Flash and Cyborg. Ezra Miller and Ray Fisher. They're going to be making a cameo appearance on today's episode. Cameo appearance, a little snippet from them. So you're going to hear from both Ezra and Ray later on. By the way, my in-depth chat with Ray Fisher's Justice League movie dad, Joe Morton, that's on episode 203. So if you haven't heard that, you're going to want to check that one out as well. He talks about Ray, he talks about Justice League, he talks about a bunch of stuff. So there you go. All right. It's Wizard World. It's comic books. It's superheroes. And it was a lot of music. There was a lot of music going on there this year. And Kato Kaelin karaoke. I kid you not. Kato Kaelin was there doing karaoke. You just had to be there to see it. There are a lot of bands there. There's a lot of music piped in. So here's my point. You're probably going to hear a bit more of a musical background on some of these interviews than you have heard on some of my past times I've taken the show on the road. So hopefully I got the microphone close enough to these talented folks. I think I did. You could, it's pretty good. But you're going to hear some music, musical accompaniment every now and again. We're going to be talking about bringing comic books to life, so I'm going to be bringing these folks to you. First up, what you can expect from a Wizard World show and the latest on some big announcements with the PR manager for Wizard World, Jerry Milani. Well, what would Wizard World be without Jerry Milani? Jerry, welcome to Comic Book Central again. Glad to have you here. Thanks for having Comic Book Central out to another Wizard World.
Excited that you guys can make it out. Thanks.
Yeah, I got to ask you, can you move the show from March? It's Cleveland. It's March. I got to ask you, it's so cold here.
I know, and I want to go to an Indians game. I haven't been able to. We've been here four times, and none of them have coincided with the Indians
April
schedule.
Or May. Can you guys push this to April or May? You know, you nice spring show, you know?
Our schedule is such a, you know, everything is affected by everything else. So it's, when is the center available? It's how does it fit into our schedule? What else do we have going on? If we have Portland going on 1 week, we can't be in Cleveland the week before or the week after. The trucks, you know, it's not logistically possible to really do that properly.
All over the country.
So we really look at lots of things that go into scheduling.
All right.
And right now, Cleveland is in our March wheelhouse.
All right, next year
will be the week following. We'll be 1 week later.
You're getting a little bit deeper. You're getting closer to spring.
March 10, 11, 12. Well, last year we were here over St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
So we've still hit March, but we're doing the best we can to
get what
we can do with what the center has.
I got to ask you about this huge release that you guys had. This press release came out, teaming with Sony Pictures Entertainment to discover, develop, and incubate new intellectual property. How do you incubate? What are you incubating? What are you cooking up right now?
Well, it means a lot of things. I mean, right now, Sony, starting really in Portland, is going to have a presence there where they're maybe meeting artists, maybe meeting someone on the show stage, maybe meeting someone in a Q&A panel. It could be a lot of things. And by incubating it, it could be where they find a property that they think has potential and work with them and try to make it into something that works on the Sony platforms, which could be any of the multimedia platforms that Sony has right now.
So is there something specific being cooked up right now, or are these just in talks?
Yeah, it's not. Well, no, it's specific that Sony and Wizard World are partnering.
They're looking
at
it, yeah.
That's solid. That's already done. Now, what that means or where it goes from here, it's open-ended, and I think that's what's cool about it. So it's not only, well, if you're an artist, you can do this, or if you're a writer, you can do this. It's really could be anything that goes on at Wizard World because there's so many different things that happen here.
So this is something that sort of happened organically over the years. So you get these different artists, you get actors, you get writers, you get producers, you get artists, you get storytellers, you get writers, all these different people coming together, and it's just a matter of shaking hands and seeing who fits with what and maybe come up with some new characters. Is that a possibility?
What Sony likes is that we're not in New York and not in L.A. We're everywhere else. So they know what's in L.A. They're there already. They know what's in New York. They have presence there. They don't know what's in Cleveland. They're not here. They don't know what's in St. Louis. They're not there. So for them to have the opportunity to actually meet people and see what they're doing and talk to them, I think is going to be we're the experts in that, and they're the experts in taking a great idea and taking it to the next step.
What excites you most about this partnership?
A connection with a company like Sony that understands or that likes the fact that we're an expert in our space and wants to partner with us because we have a particular expertise that they want and that we have now through working with them. Unlimited opportunities. It can be movies, it can be television, it can be internet, it can be anything that Sony's involved in anywhere in the world.
Well, there's so many platforms now, because back in the day it used to be movies or TV, and that was it. And now all of a sudden you get these streaming services, and like something might pop up on YouTube, something might pop up on Amazon Prime or Netflix or something. So I'm guessing the door is pretty much wide open to any platform you guys can hit.
It is for Sony, and also our other big deal that we've done recently is with CN Live, a Chinese entity. There's only 7 entities in the entire country of China now. That's a huge country. It's the most populous country in the world that can stream over the internet in China. And now we're partnered with one of them to produce 4 hours of coverage, 4 hours of content every day that's going to roll over. 4 hours, 4 hours, 4 hours. So it'll run over six times, and that's going to get Wizard World, the name, and Wizard World, the brand, out to a whole new realm.
Now, these sort of things that are happening at the shows, or is it original material that you're developing? Like, what are they seeing in this 4 hours?
It's both. It's everything. It can be stuff that we produce at shows. It can be that we're partnered with a production company, ATI, that does that for
their world. So it could be like Q&As or something. It could be just shows that are put on, interviews with actors or something, or it could be just something
completely original. Completely
original. Oh,
man, and
huge.
For us to have that connection, you know, it was a little bit nebulous last year when we first announced it. And then last week, you know, we have a name for it. We have a partner that distributes worldwide already. Content. So we're moving in lots of directions, but all of these things that we do, all these things we talked about, are contingent on us having good shows. If we don't have good shows and we're not the experts in the pop culture convention circuit, then there's nothing. So that's going to always be the focus, what we do in the conventions.
Well, we're at a good show right now. It's Cleveland. Who's here? I know it was a disappointment. I know Stan Lee, we hope he gets better soon. We saw his little video out there. He's working on beating the pneumonia and getting over it. So we didn't get Stan here. But, man, you got some of the Justice League
hanging out
with us in Cleveland. Tell the listeners who are here now and then who we can expect at some upcoming shows.
Well, we have Ezra Miller and Ray Fisher. So it's a one-third maybe of the Justice League, if you will. And they'll also be with us in Portland next month. So we're starting. That's the first time they've ever been at shows. So for us to get some new blood to go to places and bring new celebrities that people haven't met before, not only at Wizard World shows but at any show, is going to expand the universe of people who want to see what we've got all at our shows. And I always say, you might come here because you love the Justice League and you want to meet Ezra and you want to meet Ray, but you're going to run into 50 other things before you even get to see them, and then you're going to cap off your day with getting a photo with the two Justice League guys. It's the full immersive experience is what we love.
We got some Doctor Who here. We got Doctor Who represented. Who do we got now?
Yeah, we have David Tennant and Billy Piper.
Nice.
So a companion couple, and David is one of the most popular guests at our shows. He's making a special one-day appearance. He's coming in from Seattle. He's doing the show in Seattle and then coming out here to make an extra appearance just because, it's a good city. He's been in this region before, and it's been great for him.
Nichelle Nichols, a mainstay at Wizard World. Uhura's always hanging out with you guys, so it's nice to see her.
She's royalty in this
she
space.
Is.
Basically, she can write down, here's all the shows I want to come to, and we've reserved her spot. She's as long as she wants to come to shows. People want to still meet her, and she's just the sweetest.
She's amazing. There's the guests. And who's coming up on some of your shows? What's on tap for the spring, summer, on through the year?
Yeah, it's great. We have right now 13 shows planned with a few more where we're looking to add the dates at the end of the year, some shows. So we're hoping to complete our schedule for that fourth quarter soon. It's some of the folks who are here. We're going to be, Lou Ferrigno's going to be swinging back in. We're hoping that when Stan Lee is feeling healthy and upright, he's, again, he has a carte blanche. He tells us what shows he wants to come to, and we'd love to have him. So it's, as many different realms as we can get into, the Doctor Who's, the Marvel books, the DC movies, and now who knew what Black Panther was going to be, that it was going to blow up like this. So
and Black
now we
Lightning.
Can look kind of deeper
those are
in.
Like, you got TV and movies going on, so that opens up a whole guest list for you guys.
Part of our job is to anticipate which movies and which properties are going to be great and try to schedule appropriately. And sometimes we react to what fans love and what becomes. And no one knew how great the movie would be and how well acclaimed it would be, and now they do. So, we've been working on that as well. So we hope to, have some more opportunities in that area too.
I know you're going to be in my neck of the woods again, Columbus, Ohio. You guys always put on a fantastic show there. A lot of cities coming up. When fans want to find out if you're going to be in a town near them, where do they want to go?
Yeah, wizardworld.com is the best spot. It'll list all the cities, and then under each city we'll have who's coming, all the artists who are coming out, all the different, when you get close to the show, the programming panels, all the entertainment stage.
Family friendly. There's so much going on for families, too.
Kids 10 and under are free. We have a kids zone in the back. We want to introduce the next generation of fans to what Wizard World is all about. So up to two kids per parent can come out and really experience the Wizard World Kids Zone, but also we have a kids costume contest on Saturdays and Sundays. So we want kids to be as much a part of this action as adults.
It's so cool. My wife and I saw a bunch of little Superman and Wonder Woman running around and Captain America. It's just so cool seeing the next generation come in.
When they go up on the stage and do the costume contest and the kids and they're Superman, they're the Flash, they are that character and they believe it, and you look at them and you believe it too, which is fun.
It makes us all little kids again. That's the coolest part. So, Jerry, thanks so much for joining me today, and have a great weekend, man.
Awesome. Thank you. We're having a great time.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see what's going to be coming out of those deals. Man, there's a lot of stuff that they're cooking up. So it's going to be pretty cool to see it all come to fruition. As always, my thanks to Jerry for making me feel at home while I'm at the show. Have done a few of these. He always puts everybody at ease. It's a fun show. Wizardworld.com, that's where you want to be. Portland, Philly, Des Moines, Columbus, my hometown, Boise, Chi-Town, Madison, Oklahoma City, many others. They're all out there. Wizardworld's heading your way. Don't miss the show if it's anywhere near you. I'm telling you, you're going to have a fun time. All right, kids. Hope you got your footy jammies on. Hope you got your bowl of cereal. It is Saturday morning cartoon time with a fantastic animator director. He has worked on, man, check this out. This is just a partial list. Godzilla, Scooby-Doo, Smurfs, Flintstones, He-Man, Tarzan, Flash Gordon, and of course, I mentioned it before, one of my faves, Super Friends. Time to check in with Tom Cook. Sitting here with Mr. Tom Cook. Boy, welcome to Cleveland.
Thank you.
Sorry it's in March. where are you from originally, or where
well,
are you
I'm
now?
I'm from Idaho, so we've got snow right now, too.
Okay. Are you still living in Idaho?
I was here 4 years ago when it was 14 below zero.
When it was in February.
The very first show we did here.
When it was in February. Yeah. They at least moved it to March. I don't know if it makes any difference.
Man, it was freezing.
I'm looking at your table here when we walk by, and it's you know, you're probably not recognized immediately in the world of Superman and Tarzan and Lone Ranger and all these cool things that we love, but you pretty much had a hand in animating and directing our childhood. Is that safe to say?
That's what I hear all the time.
Okay.
I started 1978 on Super Friends at Hanna-Barbera.
Okay. Was this when it was Challenge of the Super Friends?
Yes, Challenge of the Super Friends.
Okay. So animation and direction, both?
What? Yeah, well, okay. I directed later on. I directed like Duckman and King of the Hill, Godzilla, a bunch of stuff. Like
What does that entail? Describe like sort of the difference between the two roles, animator and director.
Well, an animator draws everything and makes the move and whatever the scene calls for. The director is the one that tells the animator what to draw.
Are you hearing, as an animator, are you hearing the vocals? Are you hearing the voiceovers? You know you know what you're trying to get, and you're trying to
get
those
reactions.
We have
a storyboard which tells us what each scene is, what's going to happen in the scene, and then we have back in the day it was a cassette tape.
What's that?
That had all the voice track on it, so you could hear how they say it, so we could animate them so it looks like... You know, I always point out, if it just says look out in the storyboard, I don't know if it's going look out or if it's going look out! You know, so I have to know the difference so I can animate it different. Because obviously I just move differently just
because
of that.
Action, the way the character's positioned. Yeah. Now, is a director hovering over you while you're animating?
No.
Or is he looking at your work afterward and going, tweak this a little bit?
You go pick up a bunch of scenes. If there's any special directions that he wants to give you, he'll tell you. But usually it's all written on the exposure sheets. And if there's a special pose that he wants, he'll put a little thumbnail. And then I turn the scenes in when they're done. He goes through each scene and flips them all and makes sure they're working right. And if there's a correction he wants to make, he'll come back and give it to you and say, well, I wanted him to do this, you know, that sort of thing.
What was your favorite part about working on Challenge of the Super Friends?
The fact that I had a job in animation.
It always comes down to this. Well, somebody was paying me, I know.
No, I was a bus driver in Los Angeles, and within 3 week period, all of a sudden I was working at Hanna-Barbera.
How does that happen? Because not too many people go from driving a bus to, you know, putting the Justice League through their paces.
I happened to take a class at a college in comic book art, really so I could meet the teacher, who was Don Rico, who drew Captain America back in the 50s. So I wanted to meet him. And plus, I like to draw, so I wanted to learn more about the process of putting a comic book together. And it ends up, he worked at Hanna-Barbera. and he liked my portfolio and said I could get you into Hanna-Barbera as a student that they teach basic animation to, and you have to be recommended by somebody that works at the studio. So I got recommended, and then 3 weeks later, I get hired.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then not long after that, you went to one of my favorite companies, Filmation. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of these cool things. But let me ask you about, I think it was Tarzan, Flash Gordon, Lone Ranger. There was a certain type of animation where they were basically getting actors to act out these parts, yeah. and then you guys were animating over top of it. Can you describe
that's called rotoscope.
Loudly as this band plays behind
us? I know, that's
Sorry.
Always a problem.
I know.
It's called rotoscope, and it's basically they direct the actor, or in He-Man's case, we had these bodybuilders come in, and they direct them what to do, and then they filmed it. Nowadays, they would do it with those little nodes that they put on you and do it in 3D. But they would film you at a certain angle, and then they would blow up those film shots, and then we'd animate over it. And that's because Filmation Studios was the only studio left in the U.S. doing work instead of sending it out to Korea and Japan.
They were doing it.
So we had to cut corners, and the way to do it was to, if somebody ran through the scene, rather than redrawing it every scene of every show we ever do, we just did what was called the stock scene. And then the guy would run through, but we wanted it to look really good, so we took the time to really do rotoscope stuff, so it looked really nice.
That was the cool thing, because we'd see them running the same pattern kind of over and over again, but it looked really, really cool.
And even the villains ran in the same direction, because it was the same actor that we would just draw over them and change them into whatever villain it was.
We don't see anything like that today, though, do we? Because I think when I go back and watch the old Flash Gordons, they look unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, nowadays, everything's done in a computer, and even if you're drawing it in the computer, you can't draw like you can with a pencil.
Yeah. Lost art.
So they've really... And, I'm 65, going to be 66, so I was pretty young when I started. So the old-timers are... There are not many of us left. So,
it's this stuff holds up. It's amazing. What are you working on now? I mean, what do people are at your table? What can they expect from you now?
Well, at the table, I'm just working on whatever the fan wants. If somebody wanted like this one here, or somebody wanted a Papa Smurf.
Papa Smurf.
So I did that. But as far as a job now, I'm retired, so I'm just sitting back and
kicking back,
just doing a lot of shows, and it's a lot of fun because it keeps me in touch with the fans. And, I'm overwhelmed the number of people that still love these shows.
Well, we love watching because the animation holds up, I think, better than anything today.
Yeah.
I just watched Flash Gordon again recently.
I agree. It's
it
really
looks
good.
Amazing. Yeah. So how can fans find out more about your website?
Well, my website's down right now because, believe it or not, I've had it for so long that the technology's so old they make me take it down.
We're revamping it.
But I'm at 80sanimator@gmail.com if anybody has any questions or if they want to order a drawing or something like that.
There you go.
And that's also the same. It's 80sanimator.com when I put my site back up, but it's not going to be up for a little while. I've got so many shows, I don't have much time to do it.
They can email you and get a Super Friend Superman with the red tights on.
Absolutely.
The way he's supposed to look. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the weekend.
Thank you.
One of my favorite action heroes of all time, $6 Million Man. I packed up my copy of the $6 Million Man magazine, issue number one. I took that with me to Wizard World Cleveland because I knew I was going to be chatting with one of the incredibly talented folks who worked on that cool book back in the day. He also worked on a lot of Marvel books as well. Cue that bionic sound effect because we are going to be chatting with writer-artist Carl Potts.
Welcome, Carl Potts, to Hello. Cleveland. First time here? Or?
Yeah, this is my first time in Cleveland. The only time I've actually been in Ohio at all is I was here near the West Virginia border once ages ago. That's about it.
And I'm talking about, on Comic Book Central, we always talk about bringing comic books to life. So talking to people who take comic book characters and bring them to life on the screen. But sometimes I like to kind of reverse engineer the process. And I'm interested, first of all, how you got into... how you got into comic books, how you got into comic book art, and how you got into art in general. And then I'd like to segue that into your time with Neil Adams.
Right. Well, I've been drawing since I was a little kid, and I've been reading comics since I was a little kid. I've always enjoyed visual storytelling in all its forms, whether it was animation or film or television or comics. And somewhere along the way, the bug kind of started gnawing at me that, you know, people actually make a living at this. I wonder if I have a shot at it.
Were there certain cartoons, you mentioned animation and things like that, were there certain things that inspired you?
Well, just the, you know, the typical early Saturday morning stuff that used to be on all the time, but then a little later, you know, stuff that was a little bit more serious in a sense would be like Johnny Quest, stuff like that, that was pretty impressive. But, so I moved to, after I got out of college, I decided to move from California to New York to try and break into comics. And through a combination of hard work and a lot of luck, I ended up managing to make a career out of it. I did start out working at Continuity Studios, which at that time was a joint venture between Neil Adams and Dick Giordano.
Okay, good first gig. Was that your first paid gig?
The very first paid gig was when I was still in California. A couple of the established comic artists had moved to California, and I got to know them, Jim Starlin and Alan Weiss. And they were asked by Denny O'Neill, who was editing at DC, to basically draw a 22-page story over a long weekend to save this deadline problem that he had. It was Richard Dragon, Kung Fu Fighter number 2.
You still remember.
And they asked me to come over and help them on this marathon gig. So Jim Starlin, on the first night, that Friday night, while he's watching TV, uses a lap board while he's sitting on the couch and lays out 22 pages. And I was so...
Just right there in one
yeah,
shot.
And I thought, holy cow, if this is the industry standard, I'm totally screwed. thankfully, it's not. But
that's a lot.
So then they figured out between who was going to do the tight pencils on all the major characters and scenes between Starlin and Weiss. And then I handled a lot of the background characters and the backgrounds.
Okay.
And then it all got sent to Al Milgram to do the best he could to try and make it all look somewhat uniform. And they got the book out on time. So that was the first professional job.
Now, for our listeners that aren't familiar, how would you describe Krusty Bunkers?
Well, Krusty Bunkers was a name for a evolving collective of artists that were based at Neil Adams and Dick Giordano's Continuity Studios. And basically what happened is when an editor had a book that was really late and needed to be inked almost instantaneously, they would call up usually someone at Continuity, Dick Giordano or Neil, and say, can you pull together a crew of artists to ink this thing in a couple of days? And that crew could change. You know, early on, you get people like Bernie Wrightson, and Neil and Dick Giordano and Terry Austin and, you know, whoever just happened to be visiting the Continuity Studios, they'd say, hey, you know, ink this over here or whatever.
Put into service immediately, yeah.
You know, and I remember at one point after I got there, Sergio Aragonés did a cartoon that we put on a T-shirt for anybody who had been in the Krusty Bunkers. And it was like three or four cartoonists practically crawling all over each other as they're trying to ink different parts of a page.
Nice.
And he even did a Krusty Bunkers logo that was based on Neil Adams' signature.
Oh, man.
I don't think there's too many of those anymore. Those are pretty rare. So it wasn't like a single group. But basically, it was usually based around continuity.
So I mentioned about bringing comic books to life, but I also like to, I talked to Neil Adams a little bit about this, taking these adaptations of TV shows. So at the time, it was like, what, Space 1999?
Emergency. $6 Million Man.
That's the one I want to mention, too. Yeah. So what's the secret to making a successful comic adaptation of a successful television series?
I guess it depends on how you define successful, because none of those magazines we're working on last more than a year.
No, but they, especially the $6 Million Man one, the art is stunning.
Parts of it are, yeah. What happened was that Neil and Dick hired a group of us young whippersnapper pencilers. They basically packaged these books to be black and white comics magazines for Charlton Publications. And what he'd have us do is we'd take a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, fold it in quarters, and on each one we'd do a thumbnail for a page based on the script we got. Then Neil would look at that, and he'd take his flare pen, and sometimes he would just draw a totally different scene over what we'd drawn, ignoring what we'd drawn, and other times he'd just strengthen the drawing on it. And then we'd take those and put them in what was called an artograph machine, which was these big opaque projectors that shot straight down on a drawing desk. And we'd use that to blow up these tiny thumbnails onto full-size artboard. That was an art area approximately 10 by 15 inches. And then we'd draw tight pencils based on that. And then Neil would again come back and fix things he felt needed fixing. And then Dick Giordano would generally ink all the large faces and major figures. And then Neil would occasionally do that too. Sometimes they get Russ Heath to pitch in and do that. And then the backgrounds and background figures were usually inked by Terry Austin and Bob Wyachek. And anybody who walked into the studio was often handed a pen and said, here, go do something on this.
Were you a $6 Million Man fan? Had you seen the show? Were you familiar with the character?
Yeah, I liked it. I wouldn't say I was a fan, but I liked it. I liked all those shows. I wouldn't say I was fans of any of them. I thought Space 1999 was kind of hokey.
When you saw the finished product on the $6 Million Man book, what did you think of it?
I thought that all the guys I was working with made me look great.
I was going to say, be kind to it because I've got one in my bag.
they, if you saw what I handed in and what compared to what came out,
okay.
they improved it vastly.
Yeah.
You know, you get Neil Adams, Dick Giordano, and Russ Heath inking your figures. That's a good way to learn, too, because I could remember, and sometimes I would have copies of what I drew before, and I'd see what the hell they did with it, and I'd go, oh, that's what I should have done. And
almost like an art school as you're going through it.
It was. We learned more by osmosis than anybody usually giving us lessons. It was more like, all right, I did this, and this is how it turned out. This is much better. Let me decide how the hell that went from that to that and see if I can incorporate that into my work.
Did you work on the Power Records books at all?
Those I did not, I don't think, no.
I was curious because it was around that same time frame. Yeah. I know we had some $6 Million Man coming in there, and those are my absolute favorites. So I just was curious. I got the chance to talk to Neil about those. And
If I did, there might have been a Star Trek one I did one or two pencil pages for, but I'm not 100% sure. I tell you, it was such chaos at the time because there was like, you know, 15 different projects going on. Plus, at the same time, the studio was heavy into doing storyboards and animatics for ad agencies, which is actually how I made most of my living.
I was going to say, that's how he mentioned he made a lot of money, was through the advertising.
Yeah, I mean, I got paid as much for drawing a single frame for a storyboard as I did for tight penciling a full comic book page.
Oh, wow.
And I could knock out storyboard frames left and right quickly, but when it came to drawing comic page, it was like, oh my god, it's got to be perfect, oh my god, and it'd take me forever. And I'd redo it over and over. So if I did storyboards for most of the week, it would allow me financially to draw comics in the evenings and on weekends.
What are you working on now, and how can fans find out more about you?
Well, these days I spend actually most of my time teaching at School of Visual Arts in New York and online for Academy of Art University, but the biggest comics-related project I have going now is a large graphic novel for the U.S. Navy, the Naval Institute Press, which is starting to do graphic novels, and it's set in the Philippines during World War II and is based a lot on my family's history there.
Wow, okay. And how can we find out more about you? You online? You on social media? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I'm on social media. I don't really maintain a
You're
web
stealth.
Presence as much as I do. I'm on Twitter, but I very rarely use it or even look at it.
You're stealth. You're flying under the radar.
I have a tough enough time getting things done without spending more time on social media.
Come out to a show and see you in person and get some really cool artwork done, too.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you so much for talking
to
us today on Comic Book Central.
Thanks.
All right, Richard Dragon, Kung Fu Fighter, issue number 2. All right, we all got that. I got to go pick that one. I don't have it in my collection. I got to get it. I did look into it. I looked into it online after that interview. I found it. It's anywhere between like $2 and $8, so depending on the condition. So that's a pretty good price, man. I get it. I got to add that one to the collection. Yeah, it's not in my collection. Not yet. It will be. I'm going to go get it. But some comic books I definitely have in my long boxes. The Simpsons comic books, man, I got a bunch of those. the show itself, now in its 29th season, 29 seasons, it's unreal. Man, it premiered way back in December 17th, 1989. Phil Ortiz, he was at Wizard World Cleveland. He not only worked on that show back in the early years, but when the line of comic books that started a few years later came out, Phil got in on that. He was the artist on Bartman, Radioactive Man, Krusty Comics, right from the beginning, number one issues on all those. And of course, The Simpsons. He jumped in a few issues into that run, but man, he is still the artist on the book to this day. So if I'm doing the math right, correct me if I'm wrong. You folks out there know more about this than I do. Just let me know if I'm wrong, but I believe that's the longest run of any artist on a comic book. Is that the record? Well, regardless, nearly a quarter of a century. That's something to celebrate. We're going to celebrate The Simpsons right now with Phil Ortiz.
All right, I'm here with Simpsons artist extraordinaire Phil Ortiz. How often do you get to Ohio?
Once a year. Once a year. It's on the schedule for Wizard World, and sometimes I luck out. I get here twice a year with non-Wizard World conventions.
It's so cool. I'm watching people come up to your table. You actually Simpsonize people. You make Simpsons characters out of them.
The term is sketchinizing.
Yeah. Sketchinizing. Yeah. I thought it was Simpson. Wait, there's Simpsonizing on the other thing. Is that just in the episodes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's for the episodes.
But, you know, Simpsonizing, sketchinizing.
Sketchinizing.
Same thing.
Okay, what sparked your interest in art? How did you get involved in art? And what were some of your influences early on?
In art in general?
Yeah.
Or as a
kid, like when you're like, I could make some money doing this.
Well, I'd have to say, way back in kindergarten, they used to issue out coloring books for all the kindergarten students. And that's a form of working in the art, being exposed to art. And so some children decide to pursue it. Others just go into other careers. I just kept it up.
And what do you remember, like, what your first paid gig was?
Oh, yes. The first paid gig was a poster I did for a science symposium that had a lot of celebrities. They had astronauts, they had writers, they had Gene Roddenberry there. This is 1986, and he autographed one of my posters.
Oh, wow.
So I have that. I'm not giving that away for anything.
That's close to your heart.
Yes. I was thinking of maybe donating it to his wife, who also passed away shortly after he did. I thought maybe she might like it as a token, you know, memorabilia or whatever.
Now, I'm always looking, talking to different artists, you know, talk to Carl Potts a little bit. I'm always talking about comic books coming to life and TV, movies, animation, things like that. But I love when it gets reverse engineered and we get things like, because I kind of grew up, I love comic books, Spider-Man, Superman, all that. But I always loved when there was like the Flintstones comic book.
Yes.
Or like I think you even mentioned, like a lot of the Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Gold Key Comics.
Gold Key Comics. So did those kind of comics inspire you as well?
Yeah. I had some cartoonists from old comics that were my mentors, so to speak. Dan DiCarlo, who did the old Archie comics, he's one of them. Another one would be Sergio Aragonés, who did the Mad Magazine.
All the little
Border page strips. So I took an interest, but not trying to copy their style. I tried so hard to create a style of my own. And I have some characters of my own that I just never had time to develop because I've been working for the man, so to speak.
Well, that's the one I want to talk to you about, the man, Matt Groening himself. So how did you get involved in The Simpsons?
I was working at another studio called Calico Productions on a show, very boring show, called Denver the Last Dinosaur. This was 1989.
I don't remember that one.
You do?
I don't remember that one.
You don't remember?
No, not like The Simpsons, no.
It wasn't really that popular.
Okay.
But a friend of mine, a co-worker, he went down to a studio called Klosky Chupo, 1989, during his lunch break. And when he came back, he said, "Hey, Phil, why don't you check out Klosky Chupo? They're starting a show that was used on the Tracy Ullman show. It's called The Samsons or the Stimpsons or something like that." And I said, "Okay, you know, anything's better than working here. I'm falling asleep every time I come into work." So I went down there and I showed them my portfolio. They saw that I had worked at other studios in-house, so I had the experience for in-house work. And, you know, they said, oh, great, Phil, you're what we need. We're starting the show from scratch. So they said, they said, there's your desk. You're on payroll. Get to work. And, you know, I was there for 2 years. And I got, I left after the second season of The Simpsons because I got a call from Disney. I had never worked at Disney before. But this is not... This is not animation. This was Disney Publishing, illustrating the children's books. So I had my chance. I had my big chance to work at Disney. And then I got laid off after 3 years. But I had 2 weeks of work left, and I got a call from the art director for the Simpsons comics. And I met him when I worked on the Simpsons TV show. And he said, Phil, you're no stranger to these characters. I think you'd work. You'd be perfect for these comic books. So they gave me a little test, and they said, okay, you're in anyway, Phil. So I've been working on the comic books, Simpson comic books, since the beginning also.
I was going to say, so 25 years? Is that what we're looking at? Or
I've been associated with the Simpsons TV show for 29 years.
Yeah,
and the comics, this is my 24th year with the comics.
Okay, so we're coming up on the anniversary.
Right.
Yeah.
I started on the first... issue of the Simpsons comics.
What's the secret to a successful TV show to comic book adaptation?
Well, when Matt went in for the first time to Fox to sell his Life in Hell idea, Fox was interested in the writing in that Life in Hell strip. So they approached Matt and they said, Matt, can you come up with a nuclear age family? And Matt, in 10 minutes, just cranked something out, and they liked it. They said, wow. Okay. And Fox presented Matt with a budget. He says, okay, go get yourself an animation crew, and if you can do these one-minute shorts for the Tracy Ullman show, that'd be great. And one thing led to another, and then they said, when Tracy Ullman is over, you can start on a half-hour format of The Simpsons. So... that's where I came in.
Who's your favorite character to work on?
Sideshow Bob, I'd have to say. Sideshow Bob, because I designed him in the first season along with one of the writers. His name is Brad Bird. Brad Bird was working on The Simpsons the first few seasons, and he and I collaborated to come up with a design for
Had they had Kelsey Grammer in at that point yet or not?
He started with the first Krusty cartoon, half-hour cartoon called Krusty Gets Busted.
Yeah.
That was like, we only did 13 episodes in the first season, but that was around episode 11, 10 or 11, Krusty Gets Busted.
Yeah.
And that introduced Sideshow Bob.
Great character. How long can this juggernaut go on?
I don't know. They're working on their 29th season, so you know they're going to do 30. Anything to celebrate...
You can't stop at 29.
No. Well, after 30, I don't know if they're going to continue doing the show, but there is going to be a 30th.
Well, we're going to keep watching The Simpsons. We're going to keep reading the comics, and thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. I love Cleveland. Yeah, Cleveland's
it's awesome.
All right, if you're a fan of the hit TV show Gotham, that is basically Batman's origin story. I got a treat for you. Two amazing actors from that series. They were in Cleveland, Ohio. I got to chat a bit with both of them. First up, Sean Pertwee. He plays Alfred Pennyworth on the show. Now, for a long time in the comic books, you know, Alfred the Butler. We all know Alfred the Butler. Okay, but you know, we've seen some layers on that character over the years in the comic books, different adaptations in animation, film. So they're adding more and more to the character all the time, but nothing like we've seen in Gotham. I had a chance to ask Sean how he approached this unique take on the classic character.
All right, Sean, welcome to Cleveland.
Thank you very much.
Is this your first time in Ohio?
It is my first time in Ohio. Yeah, I should have been here yesterday, but the wind had a better idea.
It's a little tricky. Yeah, especially getting into Ohio. It's a little tricky sometimes. Okay, they've got the two of you close together. You're real close to David over there.
Yeah.
Are you okay with that? Because you guys seem to be going at it pretty... He killed you.
Well, he killed me.
You beat him up.
But I beat him up. But, yeah. We're sort of finding our paths in this season, second half of the season. We sort of try to find our way back to each other again, which is always fun to watch. But when we do unify, which obviously we do, there's a marked change in our relationship to each other. You know, you have to let the bird fly sometimes. You have to let go of the child. And, you know, I have a young teenage son myself, and I know that you have to find a way, you have to be able to release as well.
Especially in Gotham, because everybody's letting blood fly in Gotham.
Exactly,
isn't the Alfred we have from the comic book. So were you able to take anything from the comic book world into your adaptation of, because it's a completely different Alfred than we've seen, even in the movies a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, that's ostensibly the whole thing about our show, is you see these characters at a time you've never seen them before. So the first, most important question that we had, that Bruno Heller and Danny Cannon and the rest of the showrunners had, was, you know, why is he there? And the obvious answer, the obvious reason was that he was there to act as a protectorate, not just a butler, but a confidant, a driver, a security, a friend to Thomas Wayne. And that's what his unwavering loyalty is to this young man and who he learns to love. So an actual fact is that, you know, he needs the boy as much as the boy needs him. I started looking back into, because you have to find your own heartbeat for the character, your interpretation of this character. So after we started developing it, and I decided I wanted to come from the SAS, which Geoff Johns approved, and because I trained with the SAS for a different show, and I like the idea of him being like a sort of Swiss Army knife, that he can do anything, which I think is a great attribute for what Bruce later becomes. Those are the influences. I started looking back at some of the books and information. I found out a lot of stuff about Alfred, that his name is Thaddeus Crane, middle names, and he invented a rose called the Pennyworth Blue. Why he was called Alfred Pennyworth, because his life was worth a penny, because he used to carry an arsenic tablet in it, all this kind of interesting stuff. So,
okay, so you've done some homework.
Oh, yeah, I did. So I started subtextualizing, but what we were very proud and pleased about was a lot of it without researching, we actually discovered was actually there anyway. I mean, that's the great thing about being a show that has 75 years of mythos. You know, the canon of Batman has gone back 75 years, so we had
Can you tell us anything about the back half of the season that we're coming into? What, even just a tone or an overall look at the show that's coming out?
Well, the big one is, of course, is there's going to be strange unifications. There's going to be other... Well, Jerome comes back with a bang. There'll be groups of people that you've never seen together be together. And you'll see the falling apart of the city. I mean, the real falling apart, sort of imploding from, you know, like an alien, if you know what I mean.
Kind of
thing. So it gets very, very confused and dark and dangerous, which is we're heading towards the area now where Batman rises from the ashes, phoenix-like, and we're entering into that sphere. We're on our fourth season now. I think we're sort of entering into that area now, which the audience, the fans of Batman, know and love so dearly. So we're entering into that period now.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Check out Sean Pertwee doing a deep comic book dive with Thaddeus Crane. That was pretty cool, right? Love it when actors do their comic book homework. Love when we hear that. Okay, one actor who definitely, we know he does his comic book homework, is David Mazouz. He's there with Sean all the time. He plays young Bruce Wayne on Gotham. Those two, if you haven't seen the show, they're going at it all the time now. But you longtime listeners of Comic Book Central know I first caught up with David back at the Cincinnati Comic Expo. That was on episode 149 of Comic Book Central. That led a few episodes later to my in-depth conversation with David. That was episode 153. So if you haven't heard those episodes, you're going to want to check them out. Don't do it now. He's here. He's here in the lair. I got him. He's right here. I got David with me right now. Check it out. Here is David Mazouz.
Welcome back to Ohio. It's good to see you again. It's so much has happened on the show since we last spoke.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to ask you about Starlet.
Okay.
Okay, we got your little doggy here today. The last time we saw, I think she was in a Robin costume.
Probably.
Now she's in a Harley Quinn costume. Should I read anything into that?
No, she just likes to dress up. But okay. I think it's funny. I think the Robin costume that she was wearing in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
A fan had given me there that day. And so
at the convention.
At the convention. Yeah.
Okay. So, but this
that's what inspired us to dress her up every convention. attraction.
Okay, so don't read too much into the Harley Quinn thing then, right?
You can if you want. That's all I'll say.
I gotta talk about suiting up. The last time we spoke, you hadn't put on a suit yet. You're working on the voice. You had the voice down. You got a suit now.
Yeah.
First time in the suit, what did you think?
It was so cool. We had done a lot of fittings, but the first time I wore everything at once was the first time I walked onto set with it, and we were shooting a green screen of me on top of a roof. And it was amazing. It was just a great feeling.
I asked Sean this. I'm going to ask you the same thing. They got you guys next to each other. Are you okay with that? Because you guys have had a pretty feisty relationship the past couple of seasons here on Gotham. You guys aren't going to throw down anytime soon, are you?
Yeah. Well, you got to wait and see.
I mean, here.
Yeah,
like,
no,
you guys aren't going to, like, start throwing down right now, all right?
No, Sean.
Is it, you guys getting along? Okay, yeah, I just want to make sure everything's cool between you guys. Last time we spoke, you were reading Court of Owls, or you said that was one of your favorite storylines. Yeah. What are you reading now?
For comic books? What am I reading now? I'm doing kind of a rereading of Injustice right now, actually. What am I doing? I'm on like volume five, or not volume five. What are they? Year five.
Okay.
I'm getting mixed up. Yes, I'm doing year five volume, the second part of year five, which is like the last one, right now. But what did I do just before that?
Are you doing any preps?
Suicide Squad.
Okay.
I was doing that before that.
Any comic book preps? Because I know they talked about the Long Halloween, Batman Year One. Were you reading any of those stories coming into this season?
Yeah, I mean, I've read those already. Those are like the classics.
Okay,
like,
I know.
Those were like one of the first ones that I read.
All right. What can you tell us about the back half of the season? Can you give us any clues as to what's coming up?
The villains are going to unite, and all the villains that we've seen in the whole history of the four seasons of Gotham, or three and a half at this point, are going to come together and try to wreak havoc on Gotham, spearheaded by Jerome, who may or may not be the Joker. And
is that all you're going to give us on that?
And Bruce is going to be very involved.
Nice. Talking about Starlet, you're doing some work, some great work for our little furry friends here. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Huge goal for you guys. What do we need to know, and how can we help dogs like Starlet?
Yeah.
Home?
Yeah. So so I'm working with an organization called Best Friends Animal Society. I just launched a campaign with my other dog, Delilah, who I rescued, who's in LA right now, who's a German Shepherd. And she, you know, the campaign, the one of the Best Friends campaign is Save Them All, because we can save them all. Currently, 4,100, it's a big number, dogs and cats are being killed in American shelters every day. And so by 2025, Best Friends' goal is to make that number zero. And it's possible we can save them all. I saved my best friend Delilah, and she saved me. And the best thing that anybody listening to this can do is three big things. The best thing to do is adopt your next pet. If you're gonna get a dog, don't go to a store. Don't shop. Adopt. And then you can also definitely donate to Best Friends. That also helps. And volunteer. You know, at a lot of the Best Friends shelters, any local shelter, where they're, you know. It's great to volunteer and to help out and to get these dogs the homes that they deserve.
Great catching up with you. Enjoy the weekend.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, the website you want to head to if you want to find out more, bestfriends.org. That's where you want to go to find out how you can help save them all. Fantastic goal. They're doing some great work. Look, I've got a rescue dog right here in the lair. He's awesome. I'm so glad we did that. I highly recommend a rescue animal if you are thinking of getting a pet. Thanks to David for joining me once again right here on the show. David is absolutely a friend of Comic Book Central. He's a regular now, right? Three-timer? That's a regular on the show. Friend of Comic Book Central, and he is a friend to the animals. Protecting Gotham on TV, he's protecting animals in real life. That is very cool. Another cool thing, how cool was it that a fan inspired him in Cincinnati with that doggy costume? Now they're taking it to all the conventions. I'm telling you, he loves the fans. The fans love him. Look, a lot of these folks, Sean, they were just interacting with fans all weekend. Man, it is fun to watch everybody just getting along and having fun. Gotham Season 4 continues on Fox. They fired it up again a few weeks back. We're right in the middle of it. Set your DVRs if they're not already set for Gotham. And again, the Best Friends website, bestfriends.org. Check them out. All right, we talked about Super Friends earlier. That was the 70s version of the Justice League. How about a little 2017 version of the Justice League? Ezra Miller, Ray Fisher from last year's blockbuster smash hit Justice League, The Flash and Cyborg. Yeah, they were at Wizard World Cleveland as well. Now, here's the thing. Okay, you folks know how hard I work to get these interviews. I'm always trying to bring you interviews with these talented folks who bring comic books to life. Okay, for Ezra and Ray, their schedule at Wizard World Cleveland, it was packed. Not a chance to interview them at the show. That's to be expected. They're running Six Ways to Sunday all the time. But they did have a Q&A in Cleveland. You folks know I've got plenty of questions. I'm always looking to get some answers. So I, of course, jumped right in at the chance to question the super duo during the Q&A. Actually got two questions in. I sneaked an extra question in. You'll hear this. Here is a Justice League Comic Book Central cameo by The Flash and Cyborg, Ezra Miller and Ray Fisher.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Cleveland, gents. This question's for both of you. Ray, I had a chance to chat with your movie dad, the great Joe Morton, about the challenges of working with two directors on this film, and also sort of two different movies a little bit. We talked about that. And also, if you could tell us about your preps, your comic
book
prep.
You made two different movies? I've only seen one of them.
Did you get paid for two different movies?
Alter Ego Cyborg.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
So just the challenge of working sort of with two different directors as this came about, the challenges that you came into for this, and then maybe some of the comic book preps that you did for your individual characters.
Well, I'll start with the comic book prep first. Comic book prep-wise, once I booked Cyborg, I was sent everything from the Marv Wolfman Teen Titans original Cyborg iteration up through, oh yeah, that's like my favorite, yeah. Up through the New 52, where Geoff Johns introduced Cyborg as a founding member of the Justice League. I read a different comic every night. It was like my little bedtime treat. And so, you know, by the time we got to shooting, which was like 2 years after I booked the role, I had literally just gotten through just about everything. And that was on the comic book prep side. Working with two different directors, obviously we had a bit of a tough time with Zach having to step away from the project. And, you know, I think we all owe him a great debt of gratitude for bringing us into his vision for the Justice League. But at the end of the day, the best way to sort of honor him in that way is to do what you have to do and put your best foot forward, no matter who's at the helm. But I think that's a challenge that anybody would have faced. You know, building that sort of rapport with one person and then having to switch gears all of a sudden.
I'd say that, you know, there was, I felt like we were ultimately, I mean, all things considered, immensely fortunate to work with Zach and to work with Joss. You know, I mean, we got to work with like the two most incredible behemoths of the of this game. And I feel really blessed to have had that experience, you know, and am deeply, deeply grateful. And yeah, I also read all of the Cyborg comics.
Thanks.
Know
enjoy the weekend.
Know thine enemy.
I mentioned earlier that I interviewed Ray's movie dad, the great Joe Morton, on episode 203. So if you haven't heard that episode, you're going to want to check that out. He had something to say about the Cyborg backstory that's still out there that didn't make it into the film. Good conversation with Joe Morton on that, so check it out. Hoping to welcome both Ezra and Ray to the show properly. Glad we get that little cameo in there, but in-depth interviews would be very cool. We'll see if we can make that happen. Stay tuned to Comic Book Central. You know I'm working the phones on this. We'll see if we can make it happen. But I'm so glad that they opened up the panel to some audience questions. Look, it's Wizard World, right? That's what you can expect. They got these great panels, a lot of fan interaction with the guests, so guests galore all the time. That's what you can expect. If Wizard World is coming anywhere near you, get tickets and go. Again, the website is wizardworld.com. All right, kids, that's it for today. Oh, there's a lot of guests today. This was jam-packed with superpowered goodness. Hope you enjoyed my trip to Wizard World Cleveland as much as I did. That was fun. My thanks to Jerry Milani, Tom Cook, Carl Potts, Phil Ortiz, Sean Pertwee, David Mazouz, Ezra Miller, and Ray Fisher. Man, that was fun. Jam-packed episode today. But look, I'm not slowing down. If you think I'm taking a break after all that, think again, because next week on Comic Book Central, she plays Barry Allen's mom, Nora, on the hit TV show The Flash. She inspires our hero on TV. And next week, the lovely and talented Michelle Harrison, she's going to be gracing us with her presence right here in the lair. Can't wait for this one. It's going to be fun. Until then, go out and make some plans for your next comic book convention. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.